Welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, a weekly podcast from Hobeck Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, mystery, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of running a creative business in this challenging world. We'll hear from the people who make this possible, the authors, the cover designers and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on the Hobcast Book Show from Hobeck Books, as we combine trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello.
Hello, and welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, episode number 120.
It is.
My name is Adrian Hobart.
My name is Rebecca Collins.
And together we run Hobeck Books, UK independent publishers, of the following four genres.
Suspense.
Mysteries.
Crime.
And thrillers. Welcome to the show. This is a show where we talk about the publishing process, running a company in a difficult world, the coronation.
The cat.
The cat.
The weather.
And all things in between. So welcome to the show, and our guest this week is Matt Adcock, who is a cyberpunk author.
Yes, cyberpunk, which I confess I didn't know much about before, but fascinating genre, subgenre.
Absolutely. He's got a fantastic career record as well, having interviewed many Hollywood stars as part of his previous roles. He's also in PR as well, but he's a writer of cyberpunk, amongst other things. And
his first son is the same name as my first son. And the reason will be revealed in the interview.
Yeah, we'll reveal that. So Matt Adcock is our guest. We can't start this week without reflecting on the coronation. As we record this, this is Saturday evening, and King Charles has now got his crown, as indeed has Queen Camilla. And it was a splendid occasion.
It was lovely.
I was actually very surprised to find you watching it. This morning, well, because you'd never really shown any interest in things royal before.
Well, okay, so yes, I have no objection to the royal family. They're very pretty, but I don't particularly, I'm not a fan or anything, you know, I don't follow them. They're quite interesting when they do bad things, that's fine. I don't mind them being there. I'm not, you know, off with a head type person. But the Queen's funeral, you may remember, I just refused to watch it because it was a funeral. I don't want to watch a funeral. It's too depressing. And I had lots of work to do that day. But today, being a Saturday, I thought I'd put it on in the background. And I quite enjoyed it.
You did. One comment you made was, too much music.
Oh, for God's sake, they sang so much. I mean, really.
Well, I was listening to a podcast which was reflecting on coronations past. And apparently, the first time they performed Zadok the Priest, which was the piece by George Frederick Handel, which was first used for George II, they actually sang it at the wrong point in the service, the choir. And then they also sang some of the wrong words the first time. I mean, it is a fabulous piece of music. It is synonymous with the anointing ceremony, which was behind screens this time.
You'll have to remind me which one that is. Just hum it.
Oh, come on. You can't expect me to do it. I could play it on the guitar if you want. It was quite difficult fingering, if that's not too graphic of way to put it. But anyway, you know how it goes.
It's fine. I'll Google it later.
Well, anyway, it's a fabulous piece of music. No, it was a great occasion. And I thought, as usual, knowing what goes into these things, because having been involved in church services, even on a minor scale, the amount of planning that goes into every aspect of it, it was incredible, really.
And I loved his presence. Not his presence on him being there, but his orb, his gardening glove, his ring, his bracelet.
His spurs. You like the spurs?
Spurs. He got spurs as well. I mean, you know, it's like a birthday, special birthday.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, they will be handed on to William as well. He'll get them eventually.
Well, obviously when Charles has gone to a better place, surely, so he won't miss them.
Yeah. I mean, I just thought that the actual crowning element, putting the crown on Camilla was
funny.
She did look quite fearful when the Archbishop placed it on her head and didn't quite get the angle right to start with.
Yeah, she was sort of prodding her hair out the way, wasn't she?
Yeah.
It was almost like it wasn't comfortable, but it's difficult, isn't it? 'Cause I'm sure it isn't very comfortable.
Mm, Yeah, you know, and what's the phrase, the terrible millennial phrase people used? Props to put the Penny Mordaunt for holding that sword quite as steadily as she did for hours on end.
Props, what's that mean?
Oh, I guess it means, you know, congratulations to, or...
Oh.
You know, it's one of those dreadful phrases. Anyway, I thought she did amazingly to hold that saw, which weighs 3.5 kilos, for quite, you know, as long as she did.
Yes, and so her outfit was apparently some designer outfit. I thought it was deliberately emulating Henry VIII style woman's clothing or something.
Well, she has her own style, and it's usually that sort of thing. But Penny Mordaunt, well, one person commented, why have they nicked a Starfleet uniform, Admiral's uniform, from one of the Star
Trek
films?
Yeah, she totally did. Yeah.
It, you know, ceremonial outfit. Anyway, no, look, it's all gone off successfully, and that's fabulous. But interestingly, it has had an impact on publishing, because the number one book is a children's book called King Charles in the country at the moment.
And Harry, is his book is the number one audio at the moment as well.
Oh, spare, yeah.
Spare.
And the official Order of the Service is number 10 in the book charts at the moment.
You can buy that as a
book?
Yeah,
people have been buying it at number 10. We ought to, while we're talking about charts, congratulate a friend of the programme, Rachel McLean, for being number one in the ebook charts.
Yes, and
for the
Simon,
Lighthouse Murders.
Simon McLean is number two, so that's interesting.
Blimey,
in itself, isn't it?
Yeah.
That, you know, two independently published authors, two very successful independently published authors, are dominating the charts.
Well, it's interesting because she sent an email, I've just read it, and it arrived today, where she's outlining to her readership, which is very, very considerable now, that she's worked out the next 20 books she's going to write.
Oh, she's a... I was going to say Johnson Peace.
Well, I mean, certainly a
planner.
What she's doing, she's using some of the fringe characters from her previous books. The Zoe Finch series, I think, is one of them, isn't it?
Yeah.
And she's spinning them off into sub-series as
oh,
well.
Right.
But she's worked it out. Now, that's great. And I know that she was in 20 Books Seville recently. Do you think, I mean, this started me thinking, we were talking about this on AI, about people using AI to generate plots and then filling the gaps.
Mm.
Is she thinking that way, maybe, that you can actually feel confident that you can knock out 20 books? I mean, I just wonder.
Oh,
because
I don't know.
She's always been at the vanguard of trying new things.
Yeah.
And famously, when she writes, she actually writes by using dictation.
She does, yes. Sat in the car doing the school run, she said.
So, yeah, absolutely. Actually, listen back to the episode where we got Rachel on, and you've seen her at London Book Fair, and we bump into her at events. She is an inspiration, without question. We wish we could repeat her commercial success. Perhaps we will one day, but we'll endeavour to keep doing that. But it's fascinating, really.
Yeah, her story, it's a great story. So, yeah, listen to the podcast. It was about 18 months ago, wasn't it, she was on.
Now, we were talking about Penguin Random House just in passing because Harry's book, Spare, is the number one audio book. What I wanted to bring up was that they are shutting down their third-party distribution hub in Grantham, which is apparently going to affect about 200 third-party publishers.
200? That's quite a lot.
Actually, no, maybe I've got that wrong, but a lot of publishers.
Yeah.
200 staff are going.
Okay.
Just clarify that. So they're shutting it down. And I think that we have approached in the past another sort of rival who were actually due to be taken over by Penguin Random House.
Oh, Simon & Schuster.
Simon & Schuster, and asked them whether they would consider distributing our books into retail. So this is not an unusual phenomena in terms of that practice. But if Penguin Random House are pulling out of that and in an effort to save money, even though they have had the best-selling book of the year, it is a big blow, I think, to people who previously have relied on that service, I would imagine. I mean, we're not in that position yet. We're looking at another solution to get some representation into retail, because the fact is that, realistically, you need to have an ongoing sales relationship with the retailers. And they're just not interested in talking to small publishers like ourselves. So you have to go and find somebody to represent you in that fashion. And there are a number of outfits who did this or do this. And Penguin Random House have been doing it for other people. But clearly there's no money in it anymore. So sad for the 200 people likely to lose their jobs, but also a massive blow to the wider UK publishing economy and ecosystem.
But we do have some better news, don't we, in terms of printing and publishing.
We do. This is a really significant change.
Mm.
So another email landed this week, and initially, I almost skipped past it, as you do sometimes. but actually, this was a really important one. It came from the IPG, the Independent Publishers Guild, which we are members. And it was to announce that after long negotiations, CPI, who are one of the two biggest book publishing firms in terms of actually printing books in the UK, have done a deal with Gardeners. Now, Gardeners are the sole distribution network left in this country, and they do everything. And the relationship is this. CPI are going to move into essentially print on demand with a direct relationship to Gardeners in a similar way to the way that Ingram Spark have previously been the only people doing this. But this is a difference. So if Gardeners get a request from a retailer for a particular book, they will then go direct to CPI and order it to be printed. And that is a complete different situation to where we would have to, run stock. Or it's with Ingram, their relationship with Gardeners and into bookshops was not that strong at times. It breaks down quite often, doesn't it? We found that.
Well, the difficulty is that the retail discount we have to set with our Ingram books is on the low level. And there are some bookshops that won't buy a book at that discount. They want a higher discount, which they can get from books that they get from Gardeners, printed at places like Clay's.
So what some publishers are saying they're going to do now is order their stuff from CPI, they do the print run. But if they have a run on or it becomes a popular book, what we have had to do with our relationship with Clay's, who are the other big outfit, is that we have to contact them on a regular basis to find out how many are left in stock. That would never be a problem anymore because that would be directly dealt with in the relationship between Gardeners and CPI. And you would just take the... you would take the sale.
But the interesting thing is because, it's a very competitive industry. And I wonder if Clay's might react in some way.
Well, they're going to have to.
And Ingram as well.
We have no complaints about Clay's. We've had a fantastic relationship with them in the last couple of years. And in particular, they've been very helpful, haven't they, with the sales we did recently into Malta.
Oh, which completely. And even when something did go wrong with Clay's and it was somebody's fault at Clay's and they fessed up straight away. Rectified it as quick as they possibly
which
could.
Which is so a very different approach to some of the other people in this industry.
Mm.
You never take responsibility, Amazon. But anyway, it is a significant change. Now, Ingram Spark immediately responded, or at least it coincided.
Yeah, I was going to say,
strangely
we don't know for
coincided.
Sure, but...
Well, at the beginning of May, they decided that they're no longer going to charge setup fees for your titles. And this was between $25, $50, wasn't it? Something like
that. Yeah, and also you had to pay if you uploaded a revised version, which that was actually the big stinger for us because... sometimes we have a quote that comes in late for the cover or there's a couple of typos and you upload it to Amazon, it doesn't cost anything. But Ingram was always $25 each time and I always thought, oh, I don't want to pay that.
No. I mean, obviously, so many books get published with typos. We try and weed them out and there's always something creeps through. It doesn't matter what it is. But, if you get it down to about five, you're doing well. I think that because there are some very popular books that are out there, and goodness me, I've narrated books that have been out for 10 years and they're full of typos still, and these are the retail versions. So, it is a nature of the industry that things get missed, but obviously a lot of the effort in production is to get those out of the way. But if it's costing you $25 a time to correct a spelling mistake or a grammar error or something like that, then that is a problem. That is expensive in relative terms. Now, they have just decided they're going to make that a free thing. They're not going to charge for that anymore.
And that's quite a lot of money, I would have thought.
That's a lot of revenue, but that must be a response, surely, to this big threat to them, which is CPI and the relationship with Gardeners. And something that is irresistible in terms of wishing to explore it from our perspective, because one of the things that is a drag for you, because you do this, is to have to keep checking stock levels. Not having a way of checking online how many books of the 200, 300, 400 books that you've printed
yeah.
are still available to distribution is a pain.
And also, one of the, I think the biggest benefit of this change is if we print at Clay's and we print at, say, 200 books and good sales to start with, but as is natural, you know, they sort of slow down. But then you get to sort of 20 books left and you think, do I want to print 200 again and pay storage costs for 12 yeah, this, months plus?
This is, that is a very, very, very good point, is that, you know, obviously the general pattern is that you'll sell more books at the beginning of a book's first 3 months than you will a year down the line.
Particularly with paperbacks, yeah.
Right. And so, yeah, but it's uneconomical to knock off another 100 at that stage. You just can't do it at this, you know, you have to order like 200 to make it worthwhile.
Yeah, we have faced this issue.
Yes, it has been a problem. So that wouldn't be a problem anymore, because any short run, you know, run-ons of a popular book can be absorbed by that system and it will be done automatically. And that is...
That's huge.
That is terrific, actually. Mm. So we'll watch that with interest. And I think we'll have to, you know, consider which printer that we use and what system we use in future. But I think that's been quite a seismic change in our side of the market. No question about it.
Yeah.
Okay, that wraps up the news for this week. Let's get to our feature interview, which is with Matt Adcock. I didn't really know what cyberpunk was. And I think that was the obvious question to ask him when we started.
Well, I actually got confused with steampunk, didn't I?
But you did. You did. Very much so. Hello, Aki. The cat has arrived, as you may have heard. She's not saying a lot now. She's just staring at you going, why are you waving a microphone in my face? Get out of my face. Anyway, we'll talk to the wonderful Matt Adcock. Matt Adcock, thank you for joining us on the Hobcast Book Show.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Got to start with one question, because it's something I need clarification on.
Sure.
Cyberpunk.
Okay.
Most of our listeners probably aren't familiar with it. So what are we talking about when you've got a passion for it, you write in it? What are we talking about?
Great. Yes. I mean, I am very passionate about it. And if you've seen anything like Blade Runner at the cinema, you'll have some idea what cyberpunk is. It's basically a dystopian future world where there are large corporations that run most of everything. But there are also small individuals fighting back against it. And that could be detectives. It could be hackers. It could be, you know, robots. So it's that kind of juxtaposition between high tech and low life is the sort of standard definition.
Right. In that context, we're basically watching a world where we're quickly
approaching... I was going to say, that sounds like reality to me.
That future.
It is terrifying how accurately some things have been predicted, you know, via sci-fi films and books, and the cyberpunk edge of it seems to be one that is being acclimatized and taken on board by lots of tech companies. In fact, if you want to work for Xbox, you have to read Snow Crash, which is one of the sort of revered cyberpunk texts, as part of your induction program. So that's quite a fascinating.
I like the idea that you have to read a book to get a job yeah. somewhere.
But at the
we
same
could
time-
do that.
Yeah, but I mean, in a way, that is quite eerie, isn't it? That, you know, that part of the indoctrination process for working for Xbox and Microsoft is to read. I mean, admittedly, I'm sure it's a very good book, but what's the thinking, do you think, behind that?
I think it probably alerts you to dangers that are coming down the line in terms of tech, but also hopefully would stimulate you to, you know, embrace wild opportunities and push the boundaries. I think that's what they're hoping for, rather than training up an army of hackers to take over the world, which is also a possibility.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, true. So when did your fascination for this sort of area come in? Did you start, I mean, I'm not in the cyberpunk side of things, but I'm certainly a bit of a sci-fi geek.
Oh, me too, really.
Yeah, a bit, you know, my epiphany with that question, apart from Tom Baker as Doctor Who, is being 7 years old and watching the first screening in Cambridge of Star Wars, A New Hope, episode 4, whichever one you want to call it. That just absolutely transformed my mind from there on in. I think all the neurons rewired that night.
Yeah.
That explains a lot.
I'm pretty with you on that. Sci-fi, A New Hope, Star Wars was the first film I saw at cinema that I can really remember, and has had a lasting impact on my life. I called my first son, Luke. So every night I can say to him,
"Wild, this is Luke."
Nice. So he's 26 now. He's pretty sick of me, you know, acting Darth Vader on him. But
and doing the dad quote,
of course,
or the father quote.
And at Christmas time, saying, "Luke, I felt your presence" and stuff like that. You know,
we do that one, yeah. Yeah. Well, in just in that spirit, my eldest son is called Ben. So there you go.
Did you give him Kenobi as a middle name? Because I wanted to give Skulker to my Luke, but my wife's too sensible and wouldn't let me.
Oh, I wanted it to be Maximus, because Gladiator had just come out at that point, 2001-ish. And that was vetoed. But the problem is, with a name like Hobart, my nickname at school was Hobie One Kenobi, you know, yes. Hobie One and all that sort of thing. It stuck with me all my life. And so it felt just, you know, I thought that Ben would probably face the same sort of thing. Why not call him Ben?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Brilliant. I mean, I applaud it. My favourite guest I had when I was at a book for university, we had a speaker come over from the States. He had called his first son Jedi. And I was like, as a first name, I'm like, yes, that's respect for that.
Absolutely. And what about when the when the option came up for declaring your religion on the census? I've done it at least once.
Oh, you know.
I have put down Jedi. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, if only there was a tangible force that we could tap into, you know, and to make the world a better place. I'm sure the Tories will suppress it, but I don't know if you're allowed to politics on your podcast, but
it's fine.
It creeps in occasionally. And so in terms of, you know, that is a good place to start in terms of having a passion for it. Where does it deepen? When did it really grip you, for life, really?
I started writing a fake diary, which was like a wild adventure of the sort of life I'd like to be living. And that started at school. And it kind of grew from there. My English teacher caught me writing it one day and wanted to read some. And then he said, "You should carry on writing this. This is the sort of thing. You should definitely, you know." So buoyed up by that, I wrote my first manuscript, and it took me an incredibly long time to find a publisher because I didn't have the money to self-publish it. I wanted to, you know, actually have it stand on its own 2 feet, and eventually found Burton Mayers Limited, who are a funky young sort of independent publisher.
Mm.
And they took a chance on it, and it's been great. You know, the joyful thing about having a novel in the world is the feedback, as you guys must know. And during lockdown, an artist read it and said, "This would make a great comic or graphic novel." And I was like, "Yes, please." But I can't draw. So he said, "Well, fortunately, if you script it, I can draw it." And we did a Kickstarter. We got about £3,000 to finance the first issue. And it's now going to be a series. So every chapter of the book becomes a comic in its own right. And then we'll have a graphic novel to, you know, sell to a publisher at the end. Yeah, so that's the... And then we'll get a Netflix series, and that's the plan.
I love that, though. I mean, how did you go about with the crowdfunding? How was that difficult to...
It's terrifying, I tell you, because we use something called Kickstarter, which is an all-or-nothing gambit. So you set a target, and if you make the target, great, everyone pays and you get the money. But if you don't make the target, nobody pays, and it just goes down as a failure. So it's quite a public kind of thing to do. And it was nail biting. But fortunately, we not only made the target, but you can put a stretch goal in if you want to try and do something beyond what you originally envisioned. And our vision, I thought, nothing ventured, nothing gained. We got in touch with an actual Judge Dredd artist from 2000 AD and asked if he would do an alternative cover for the comic. And he said, "Yeah, sure. About £500 is my rate." So we added a stretch goal for £500. And got it. And so we now have two versions, which is great. We've got the limited Siku artist one, and we have the normal, which is just makes my inner geek so happy.
Oh, totally.
Yeah, well, no, me too. You know, I love that idea that, you know, that's going to be sort of collectible then.
Yeah, that's the plan.
Yeah, no, that is fantastic. And I really think it's one of the best innovations, I think, in publishing in the last 2 or 3 years is the development of Kickstarter. I mean, I know of one author who's very well known who has gone for the, I can't remember how much investment it was, but I think each copy cost him $1,300 to make because it was leather, not just leather bound, but it was hand carved and all this sort of thing. And he actually raised $7.5 million
nice.
Doing this.
Blimey.
Without, you know, and so goodness knows what people were actually buying it for. But that was his invest, you know, he was risking that and he created a prototype. So there is that's one extreme. But I noticed that one of your most recent projects is to write also for people who, you know, for younger audience aimed at 10 to 12. And you did a crowdfunder for that too.
Yeah. I kind of got the bug. And Burton Mayers again stepped up to publish it, but being an unknown quantity of sort of cyberpunk for younger audience, they didn't put a big budget behind it. So I wanted to have enough to pay some marketing costs and, you know, really contact schools and, you know, get it out there. And that's worked well. So the getting an audience via Kickstarter is a fun way to do it, because instead of pre-sales where people kind of click on Amazon, you're directly pre-selling to them. So if you can do the margins and make a profit on the, you know, what you offer, and offer them some nice extras as well. So it's not just getting the book, but if you get it via Kickstarter, you'll get it signed and you get art cards and things that you wouldn't have got if you'd just gone to a shop to get it. And that way it gave us some collateral to kind of, push it out into different directions, which you might not get if you just do a standard launch.
I that's really admirable. And what's been the pickup on that? Because, you know, is there a ready audience who's been waiting for this opportunity, for something aimed at them?
I mean, I don't know if it's a huge audience. We've sold about 300 or 400 copies at launch. So, you know, it's something. It's definitely, I've got friends who put stuff out and done like double digits on launch day, which is, you know, is kind of slightly disappointing, I guess, if you put so much work into something. And but it's not all about mass numbers. It's about the connection. My favorite thing that happened with Complete Darkness, borrowing the comic, is that someone they whittled and painted two of the main characters. It took them weeks, and then they sent them to me after, you know, explaining what they'd done. And they now sit on my mantelpiece and they're absolutely brilliant. You know, it's like,
I love that.
To have inspired somebody to go to that much trouble is fantastic.
I think we're more likely to get crocheted detectives, aren't we?
Or you? What nice. Have you had that you've had sent to you? You had some bookmarks, didn't you?
It was just on Twitter. I mentioned that I was. What was I using as a bookmark? It wasn't a street.
It was a receipt or something.
It was a rasher of bacon. I think it was just a receipt. And some lady made me two really pretty wooden bookmarks with tassels and all sorts. It's really sweet.
That's great, isn't it? Yeah, that kind of audience connection. And I need to ask you, actually, you guys, because my next project, my work in progress, is an actual heist thriller. So it's not cyberpunk at all. This is a real world, for want of a better word, crime novel. And it's a very different discipline, because whereas it was sci-fi, you can make up anything and then it's suddenly law and it's a thing. Trying to write in the real world, you're limited by what actually can be done. And also time points. So as I've said it in the 90s, so I'm always furiously looking up kind of, you know, what records are out then and, you know, our reference points of Easter eggs. So I can't have people enjoying media that weren't out, you know, like Avengers or whatever. So any tips for a budding heist crime writer would be very welcome.
Okay, well, we can weave some in. And but what I think the first thing is, you're quite right about, you know, needing to work within reality.
Yeah, because people notice.
Because as soon as you introduce cops into the investigation, there will be a way they had to operate in the particular time period you were working, and indeed what evidence they could gather. And while, you know, a lot of crime, right? I mean, I'll give you an example. We had a submission this week that I was reading, and I didn't read much beyond the first three pages simply because the cop came in and did all the wrong things straight away. To the body, like covering it up. No, that's not going to happen. And you don't arrest, you know, the person who's called it in, you don't arrest them straight away on your own. And you know, charge them with murder straight away. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, that's not how it works. And so I just felt, well, you know, if you can't take the trouble to figure that out and work to something roughly procedurally correct, then there's no point proceeding with this.
Yeah, because you can be a bit creative around what actually happens, especially in terms of time. Because in real life, it's very slow, but you know, you have to speed it up a little bit.
There is that, but you're doing, I mean, the most important thing is if you're setting it historically, you have to get that detail right. Mm-hmm. And so it's amazing how the mind plays tricks that some period, let's take the 90s then. A lot of the things we remember as being, you know, the hits of a particular year. And you know, this is why Popmaster works with Ken Bruce, isn't it? Because our mind plays tricks, and we assume because we were dancing to it at university or whatever, it must have been the year it came out. And actually, it's 3 years old, and it just had a resurgence and all that sort of. See what I mean?
You mean, Or sometimes you're convinced, aren't you? You think, I know exactly what year that came out, and then you look it up and you think, no, it can't be.
that has happened. You know, one of my characters was playing a Call of Duty game, and then I looked it up and it had been released then, so I was like, okay. That kind of thing.
Also, and that is so easy to get wrong. But I mean, actually, one of our authors, and he won't mind me mentioning this, he will be listening to this, created a vegetarian option for McDonald's that never existed.
Wow.
And we did look it up, didn't we?
And I got very, very, you can't put that in. It never existed. It was only available in the Ottawa region for 2 weeks in 1987 or whatever. And I just, you can't have that in. It's just got to come out.
Another author whose his series is set in the 80s, late 80s. And I thought, I know that period really well. I was doing my GCSEs. And he had somebody press 1471 on a telephone. I thought, I know you couldn't do that when I was 16, because that was the sort of thing I would have wanted to do.
So, that's a good point. The other thing is kind of you do get very strange looks, because I've been into like a bank and asked about their response times might have been back in the 90s. And I was just like, what?
that's entirely fair.
You have a card that just says writer researching on it.
I think
not a rubber.
I think most crime authors, the successful ones, usually have a deep throat within the police, you know, retired copper who went through this and investigated robberies or whatever it would be, or someone who worked in that environment, is to find somebody who can tell you how it was and give you those little glints of detail that enrich what you're doing, you know, quite apart from the sort of character development and the plotting and all the other aspects that crime books demand, you know, having that insight. And it's interesting because we've got to know R.C. Bridgestock, who are, in fact, it's Bob and Carol.
Yeah, so I'm guessing Robert for R.
But... Yeah, and Bob was a very, very senior copper in West Yorkshire and was the policing expert on the first series of Happy Valley. And Sally Wainwright, who wrote it, actually used a lot of the things he did in that first series. She rewrote the whole series based around the sort of things that he had experienced. And so there are people who can help do that. But I think that they always have some great anecdotes that they're not, you know, they're vicariously like to be reflected in the fiction. So that, you know, if you can find someone who can do that for you, fantastic.
Yeah. But if anyone's listening and they were working armed robberies during the 90s, then either as a crook or as a cop, then, you know, please do get in touch.
It's interesting though you pick that period because it's on the cusp of when things got electronic and you know the electronic evidence became, you know, nowadays it's very hard to get away with anything like that.
Exactly.
It just isn't possible because you know your phone's going to give you away if nothing else. You know, you happen to be in that area and you BBC see all TV, modern
things.
Every modern crime drama has to have the phone drop down the sink or...
Oh, yeah, they always lose their phone, don't they?
You know, or use a burner phone. It just has to be, otherwise you get nabbed nowadays.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting thing.
The other thing is, I mean, this is not a pitch, don't worry, but it's the criminal's plan is to stage some terrorist atrocities, which obviously never happened in the UK at that time. So you've got Tory ministers' children being tied to transit vans full of bombs near airports, and all of the authorities are freaking out about this whilst the robbery happens because it's a pure diversion tactic, a very nasty one, albeit. But it's sort of the shock and awe factor that ISIS and stuff were going for with their horrific acts, but on mainland Britain, you know. So it's kind of like a kind of quite a jump of what if.
Well, absolutely. But I mean, that works if it's conceivably possible to have done it, and people, you know, you create antagonists who are motivated and you know, despicable enough, yes, dastardly enough, I should think, to do things like that, then you can get away with it. And I think, you know, a good example of someone who took the nastiness of what people did to a very great extreme, but made it work, is someone like Terry Hayes when he wrote I Am Pilgrim, because some of those scenes are just so unbelievably unpleasant. And very, very nasty.
That's the fingerprint book, isn't it?
Yeah, but at yes, the cover is fingerprint. But you know, it's amazing how dark you can take it.
Well, I'm all about complete darkness, so you know that's my
absolutely
my MO.
And people like reading dark, so
okay. Well, that's cool. I enjoyed the psychological side of it as well, because I've got a great monologue of the main baddie. Sort of trying to theorize whether he's actually a bad person or whether he's just doing something bad, you know, because he's greedy, and how whether that puts him on a spectrum of evil, you know. So it's quite, I like that kind of thinkiness rather than it just being surface level action, although there's going to be plenty of that.
You know. Well, that's an interesting thing. I mean, this is one of the great problems for crime writers, is the sense of trying to express the motivation and the mentality of the bad guys. Because you tend to see it from, you know, you're trying to chase. It's usually seen from the perspective of the people, either the victims or the people who are chasing, afterwards. Yeah. And it's the reason why you always, in episodes of Doctor Who, get the bad guys giving their soliloquy about why they're doing it.
Oh, Captain James Bond, and just before I kill you, I'm going to tell you why my plan is all like this, you know. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, but there's nothing you can do about it, or, you know, indeed.
Scooby-Doo then, like Scooby-Doo.
A little bit. Oh, you, yes, that's what.
You know, when you dastardly kids, you've got me again. I was going to do this and this and this, and it's because of this and this. And yeah.
Oh, no, I always think my favourite sort of evil monologue is the Emperor at the end of Return of the Jedi. He's going, oh, I'm afraid your rebel fleet will be, you know, all that sort of thing.
Nice exposition.
Yeah. And, you know, I've told this story on the podcast before, but you'll appreciate this. This is something that's haunted me all my, you know, for the last 15, 20 years, probably. Yeah. But I was working at Bush House for the BBC, and in the bar, there was a wonderful bar at Bush House before they closed it, down in the basement. And it was just the best bar in London, as far as I was concerned, because they had all these different language services hanging out with each other. So you had this fabulous sort of Tower of Babel
thing. Did they have fish?
They did have a fish, massive fish tank. It was about 20 foot long along one wall.
Wow.
And there's this bloke drinking a pint of Directors at the bar as I'm trying to order my beer. And I'm looking across at him going, I recognize him from somewhere, but who is it? And I'm looking across and looking across. It's only when I got back to Holborn Tube that I realized it was Ian McDermott, who was the Emperor in Star Wars, drinking at the bar.
That is quite cool.
And I just, you know, from then on, I just thought, I'm kicking myself. I could have bought the Emperor a pint and probably avoided getting the Force Lightning Fingers thing.
What's the Force Lightning Fingers thing?
Well, this is his number one weapon. He uses the dark side of the Force to shoot lightning. Pretty much, yeah.
Sorry, this
has digressed, but this is the nature of the show. So
it's all good.
you must forgive us, Matt. So let's just turn it full circle a little bit on that.
Sure.
When now you're writing in a different genre to the one that inspired you the first time, what do you take then from writing cyberpunk and being in that community into your crime writing?
Cool. Well, there's going to be lots of Easter eggs.
I like Easter eggs.
So there'll be Tarantino-esque sort of discussion of films between the robbers and their downtime or their time to kill. Lots of quoting of Aliens script from James Cameron. One of them even likes to dress up, you know, as Hicks, as he's got a Colonial Marines helmet and stuff. So, you know, I think that kind of cosplay, because being in the comic book world now, I get to go to those sort of conventions and people come fully kitted out and all sorts of weird and wonderful things. And I often get to hold a comic or my book and take pictures, which is great. And you do, and like you and, you know, the Emperor, you get to meet some of the actual stars, because when they're finished making money, signed autographs, they sometimes come around and look at the rest of the stands and you get to chat to them, which is kind of cool. So,
but have you met anyone famous then?
I mean, I've met a few people at conventions, like the Red Dwarf cast and stuff like that. But in my other life, as a film reviewer, I was a film reviewer for 20 years for a group of newspapers. I used to go to the junkets and actually meet some stars. It's just a lot of fun. So meeting people like Denzel Washington was just like total man crush, and the charisma factor was off the scale. Keira Knightley, you know, for different reasons. incredibly sweary, but a lot of fun. And so a lot of editing had to be done on her interview. But yeah, that sort of thing, they're just people at the end of the day.
Did you have to go through that process where you get 10 minutes with... Yeah. Whoever it is, I've always been
like on Notting Hill when he's yeah. Horse and Hounds.
He's Hare and Hounds. Like that, yeah.
Horse and Hounds, not Hare and Hounds.
it's a lot like that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll have to figure out which one it is. Probably is Horse and Hounds. But you know, that comes with an enormous pressure, and I always watch those with, you know, because I used to work on BBC Breakfast, and they would always get their turn for a big Hollywood thing.
Yeah.
And if they couldn't persuade people to come to Salford to go and sit on the sofa, which is pretty rare, then they would do the junket thing. And of course, then you get this really awkward thing where that you've got 10 minutes in which to strike up a rapport with some major star who has spent the last 3 days sat in the same hotel room.
Same questions. Yep.
Yeah. Mm. And so people do the word association game to try and...
There's
been all sorts of little tricks, don't they?
Yeah, it's true. And
so, I mean, you know, it always feels, I mean, I just couldn't live with that pressure of having that tiny window, having their press publicist telling you, right, he's not going to talk about that, or that. And you've got 10 minutes, and in which, you know, and if you're doing it for TV, you have to get the lights set up and all that malarkey. It's terrifying.
Yeah, it is terrifying, but it's also a good discipline. It's, you know, and you can... It makes you better if you're a good journalist and you don't just trot out the same questions. You know, did you enjoy making the film? Or, you know, what's this character like? You start to feel left field, and that's kind of, I've developed that with my blog, because when I started reviewing the films, they didn't have an online presence. It was back well long time ago. So I started a blog to put my film reviews up there, and then obviously the star interviews too went on there. But you want to role play. If I was a reader, what would I like to read? What would be interesting for me? That's my, you know, it's my rule of thumb, always has been. So if I write a press release for a company, I might, you know, what do journalists want to actually, you know, they don't want to hear how great we are and how lovely everything is. They want something interesting.
Yeah, that's interesting. So let's talk about your communication professional background and when you're writing a press release, because I haven't... written that many, but I've certainly been the recipient of plenty of terrible ones.
Terrible ones, yes.
And I do recognize that thing of, you know, basically, you know, I think people wrote, I mean, when I was certainly in local radio, this was the case. People wrote to us on the basis that they would get on the radio station because they'd written a book and they lived in the area and that was enough. And there was no angle.
Okay.
And that's always the trick, isn't it? I mean, you're thinking as a journalist and trying to put yourself in when you're writing that release. What is the thing that's actually going to hook someone in and make them show some interest in it? Because they're going to receive a dozen books that day.
Yeah, absolutely. So I felt like I'd been in training for when I got to launch Complete Darkness. And so what I did for this, for the launch, is we hired a room in a pub and I got a vicar and a Satanist to come and give a speech about hell. From two different sites. We charged £10 tickets, which got you a glass of wine and a copy of the book and, you know, entry to the event. We sold, you know, 30 or 40 tickets and had a really great evening. You know, it was fascinating to have these two voices. And I got a full page piece on the back of a newspaper as a result of it, became book of the week for that paper. The promo paid off dividends. It paid for itself and people were still talking about it afterwards. You know, it's kind of, and my rule of thumb was, if I want, what would I like to go to? I wanted to put on an event that was interesting enough that I would have paid 10 quid to go to see. And fortunately it worked. So that was, that was a really memorable evening.
Fantastic. But I'm fascinated to know how that's, you know, when you were mulling ideas over, how you struck on that one.
Was it a 3 a.m. idea?
It kind of grew out of the plot of the book, because the pitch for Complete Darkness is that in the near future we map hell by mistake, looking at dark matter. So my kind of, what is hell? You know, because it's a fantasy to many people. It's a scary, you know, tale to some. It's a reality to some fundamentals out there. So, you know, I think it that kind of unknownness, it's kind of, everyone's got an opinion on it, whether they think, dismiss it as some just a scary brainchild of the medievalists who wanted to control villages by having one priest rather than the garrison soldiers, or whether that's, we all do have souls and our eternal outlook is either good or bad. So yeah, that kind of ooh factor is kind of what prompted me.
And it's interesting because, I mean, in modern discourse, we don't get those sort of discussions anymore, certainly in mainstream media, really. I'm thinking of the occasion when the very, very famous example of when Life of Brian came out.
Yes.
And they had John Cleese and Michael Palin on one side, and they had Malcolm Muggeridge and Mervyn Stockwood, who was the Bishop of Southwark at the time.
That's right, yeah.
And the way that went, and I think it was Tim Rice was the MC of that particular debate. And it is just brilliant to watch because it is a clash of generations. It's, yep, you know, the two sides. Well, I mean, clearly Cleese and Palin are the brighter of the two parties. Yes. Yeah. It's absolutely brilliant, but you don't get that sort of debate.
We're too
anymore.
Scared to have that sort of debate now, though, aren't we?
I think we are. Yeah,
that's, yeah, it's a good point. And then my youth work kind of side came out. We played a wide game in King's Cross afterwards, and the challenge was to everyone who'd come: you could go out into the pub or beyond, find someone who actually believes in hell, and bring them back, and they would explain why to the rest of the group. Then they get to be a major character in the next book. And so this one woman did. And
that's fantastic. I love that.
And, you know, they may or may not have had a few pints, but it was a lot of fun. And that's why there's already a short story that's published then, and a major character coming up who's going to be a detective, called Holly. So, yeah.
Fantastic. That is just a great story. And in terms of, I mean, you have a wider involvement in the writing world yes, with Society of Authors.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
In Hertfordshire, where you are. And I wanted to ask you, because we talked about this on the program last week, which was mm-hmm. this bookseller survey talking about the depression that people felt when they were freshly, you know, published for the first time.
Disillusionment
with the industry. Is that something that you are picking up from, you know, the membership of the Society of Authors in your area? You know, is there a disillusionment developing within publishing, or do you think that it's simply a question of people having unrealistic expectations and therefore them falling short?
Yeah, I think it really depends on the person. I went in sort of eyes open. I was just happy to be there, you know, delighted to have got any sort of contract. Everything else was a bonus. So, and being able to, you know, do things like stage a launch and, you know, now get a comic and things, it's all, that has no disillusionment on my side. But I have talked to authors who were expected more, I guess. And you can't all be J.K. Rowling. That's the thing, isn't it? It's I have friends, one friend who's spent an obscene amount of money on some PR companies who said they could get them, you know, coverage and made no sales from it. So, you know, they were seriously financially out of pocket. They'd published themselves. You know, so we're talking over 10K spent with hardly any return. And that would disillusion most people, I think. So I think there's a lot of lessons to learn. And if I'd been able to talk to this person before they'd gone, ventured into that world, I could have given them some good pointers to hopefully avoid some pitfalls. Because, and that's one of the great things about Society of Authors, is that it's a sounding board. They have top lawyers, they have book contract experts, they have translators and international right experts. If you've got any question about publishing or writing of any sort, they probably have an expert, and they're like a trade union on your behalf. They will read contracts sent to you and advise you for free. They will, you know, a lot of things. It's just like having a knowledgeable friend on your side, is how I describe it.
Yeah. I mean, what some of our authors have once we've started negotiating with them. They've talked to the Society of Authors to get advice. And I've actually found it really useful as well from our perspective, what they've things that they've noticed in the contract. And
yeah, because we, you know, ours was drafted in all good faith with one of the leading lawyers in this sphere. But at the same time, you know, we are conscious of the fact that what is standard practice within major publishing is not necessarily appropriate for a smaller publisher. You know, lifetime plus 70 years and all that stuff is difficult to swallow sometimes, but it is, you know, it's a very valuable resource. And I think that what I'm interested to know, though, is in terms of the social side of, I mean, now you're working within the crime sphere and the heist book. Are there peers that you can draw stuff from within the Society of Authors within that field?
Yeah, I mean, I'd be lying if I said I hadn't talked to a few people through the network. But I think I'm a firm believer that I guess maybe having done the junkets and stuff and talking to big names and realizing they are just people at the end of the day, there's nothing wrong with reaching out to those who you admire a great deal. And that includes people you might want to get a jacket quote from your book.
Yeah, I'm a
huge fan of Francesco Demetriou, who's did the Book of Hidden Things, and he's it's going to be a big film at some point. And I never thought he would read the manuscript and come back with a delightful quote for the back cover of an unknown, unpublished author, but he did. And so it's worth it. And I think just taking the initiative, because if you get someone on a good day, they may well have been where you are, and they may be convenient to helping you out, to just having that chat. I guess it depends. There'll be some who won't have the time, energy or inclination, but push enough doors, and I think it's likely you'll get some response.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that what's the worst they can say is no.
Yeah, so we always approach it.
And sometimes I have to sort of remind myself, I mean, even though I was a journalist for 25 years, 30 years nearly, there were times when, yeah, you did get a no and it was a knockback. But the worst thing about that was the fact that you'd gone out there on behalf of, in my case, the BBC, and you kind of, your whole office is expecting you to deliver the goods.
Yes.
And for whatever reason, you haven't got it. And that is the harder thing to deal with, actually, is the...
Well, that's why it's good to just two of us, because no one to let down.
Well, yeah. How did you screw it up would be the you know, would be the approach. But I've got to ask you another question about that junket thing, because I'm fascinated to know, and I've got some examples myself of when you've gone into a situation and whatever approach you've taken didn't work. Have you got anybody who was sullen and monosyllabic? Bruce Willis kind of
the music bloke who was funny with you, not what's his name? I'm always in the kitchen at parties, man. Not him.
No,
but sounds a bit like him.
Okay, well, we'll come back to that.
Anyway, sorry.
That's fine.
Back to you, Matt.
Yeah, I mean, most of them I managed to win over and get going. A couple of names do stick out, and one was incredibly surprising. It was Morgan Freeman, and you know, he's widely revered as such a lovely guy. You know, he's the guy that most people would want to read their epitaph, apparently, on some survey.
Yeah.
But hey, he was just having a bad day. You know, I don't know what had happened. Perhaps the person before me had really annoyed him. It well happened. But he was surly, didn't want to be there, just wanted to go, you know. And I guess if you have to read the room and understand that it's not going to be all you wanted it to be. So I almost ended up thinking on my feet, saying things to him, said, would you say something like this? And he was like, yeah, I'll say that. So I had some quotes then I could actually at least quote, rather than just sitting there like a scared rabbit going, oh, well, it was nice to meet you. Because you could draw complete blank, like you said, and then your paper for me, you know, who's got a page you've got to fill, would then be like, right, so where's the Morgan Freeman I want to interview? So there is that pressure, like you said before, but I think it makes you become fleet of foot and creative in your approach. Like I said, I've always learned that asking someone for a quote is very different than saying, here's a great quote, would you say it? because 9 times out of 10, if it's a nice quote, they'll say yes, and you've got it already written, proofed, and ready to go. But given someone a blank piece of paper, they may well say something that's not particularly useful, interesting, or fun. And so it's kind of, that's much more of a gamble.
Yeah, I think that's very fair. I mean, the person you're referring to is Gary Newman.
That's it.
Oh,
not the kitchen at parties, man, but the...
Yeah, our friend's electric.
Hit me with your rhythm stick.
No, that's in jury.
I saw him live. He's still quite good live.
Yeah, so I gather. But the... You know, the problem was I wasn't expecting to do this interview, and I had an hour with him, and I've told this story, but I arrived at I was at a local radio station and not far from you on the same train line, Peterborough, and Hereward Radio. And I arrived at my show started at 6 and I arrived at about 4:30. And the receptionist goes, your guest is waiting in in the green room or wherever we had, the pass for a green room. I said, what are you talking about? Who is it? Gary Newman. You're speaking to him for an hour before pre-record, before you do the show.
Oh, nice.
And I'm going, hang on a second. What? And they said, oh, don't worry. The press release and the CD, I've got the CD here and the press release. It was for his greatest hits.
Yeah.
And it basically descended into he was not in a good mood at all. He just had a hair transplant. So he looked like a loo brush.
Okay.
These crop circles in the forehead.
Oh, wow.
I made the mistake of saying to him when I was digging deep, and this was about 40 minutes in and things were going, I just kept playing the tunes and letting, getting it out of that way. I said, you're a stunt pilot, aren't you? And it was some distant memory of reading Number One magazine 3 or 4 years earlier, and he'd crashed a Russian fighter jet. And he just went like a funny color at me and just went, I am not a stunt pilot. I am a display pilot. It is a completely different discipline. And I take offense at someone describing me as a stunt pilot, which means I take unnecessary risks. And I said, yeah, but you did crash the yak that you were flying.
No, you mentioned it.
Not so long ago. It descended up. Yeah, let's put the extended mix of Cars on.
Yes.
The 12-inch on repeat.
I was only 20 at the time, and it was quite intimidating. But there you go. So I mean, it is fascinating insight into that whole world when you are dealing with the PRs, and they're the trickier people to deal with normally, because they're so protective, they're so anxious.
They're the gatekeepers,
and they know that if this interview goes badly, they're going to cop it from said star. So they were always people I couldn't abide dealing with, if I'm honest. And I shouldn't say this as you're in the PR game now, but my approach from being a journalist was, can we just get the PR out of the room and we get on with doing a proper job?
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of terrible PRs out there. I'm not betraying my profession by saying that. There are some who get paid for sending out press releases, not if it runs, not if they get coverage, just for sending out press releases.
Yeah.
I mean, like, that's ridiculous. I mean, that's like paying a soldier to per bullet that he fires and he can just throw it at the wall. I mean, it's there's some terrible PRs that, they'll send out press releases with typos that are boring as hell. It's just all the things you really shouldn't do and still get paid. It's a strange world, isn't it? But having been a journalist and a PR, I think that really helps, because I at least have some understanding of what they're looking for on the other side. It can help fashion that.
For sure. For sure. I think that's incredibly valuable. Going back to your graphic novel experience now and the comics as well. Are you writing differently because you know that at some point, I mean, I appreciate that you are converting complete darkness into that format, but has it affected the way that you think about dialogue, for instance, because that's obviously the principal thing that goes in text wise into graphic novels?
It's so different. The scripting element is so different to prose element. You just have so few words and you have to let visuals do so much of the talking. I'd say I struggle, but it takes a lot of headspace to understand how to tell a pictorial story when I'm used to writing just however many words I need and adding footnotes or whatever. ad nauseum. That was a thing I had with my publisher. It's like, I'm not publishing a sci-fi book with footnotes in it throughout. And then some of the footnotes are like 3 pages long. I was like, you read Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell? Because, like, you know, that has 3-page footnotes in it. He was like, does it? I'm like, yeah. So,
and actually just read a crime novel by author called Fiona Erskine, that's it. Erskine. And that has footnotes and end notes and sort of notes about some of the real people mentioned in the book as well. And it's about chemistry, explains chemistry, but it's been published as a crime novel. So absolutely anything goes as far as I'm concerned.
Plus, the joy of my footnotes is that they're entirely made up. They're a fairly funny, anecdotal kind of stuff. So, like, you know, there's a conference of atheists called There's No God and We Can Prove It. And an orbital platform hits it, and the news report it as an act of God, and that sort of thing. It's kind of
Who's your greatest inspiration?
This is easy. Ian Banks, God rest his soul. He was the master sci-fi writer, but he also, to get published, he wrote The Wasp Factory through a sort of more mainstream, I guess, horror sort of crimey element. But he was just such a character, and I got the absolute joy to meet him, and he inspired me a great deal. I was just one of the guys standing there, fan servicing with my copy of his, I think it was Use of Weapons, to be signed. But he took the time to chat, and people behind me were getting really annoyed because I kept asking questions about right plot and narrative and, you know, all this sort of thing, because I was deep into my manuscript creation point at that time. And he was an absolute love. I obviously caught him on a good day.
Mm. Oh, fantastic.
He's a great writer, though. I approve of your inspiration.
Totally. Right. I think we are approaching that time now.
Oh, well,
yeah, I know. It probably
just feels to you. Just quickly say, yes. He was, I found out recently that he was an extra in Monty Python's Holy Grail as well. He was one of the knights. I was like, that is so cool. I mean,
that is
a great connection.
Yeah.
That is fantastic. Right. Well, let's drop the tone a little bit. You might feel this whole conversation has been enormously random, and in many ways it has, but that's the way that I think our brains work. But now it is the formal moment we've all been waiting for. Rebecca's random question.
Well, weirdly, it is related to some of the things we've been talking about. So although it was randomly generated by my brain, it's about hell. And I want to know, right, you've just carked it, and you're standing at the gates and they're saying, you're going to hell. You have to convince them that they're wrong. What would you say?
Wow. I mean, gosh, on the spot. And can you imagine that exact scenario? It's probably gone for a lot of people's minds as they realise that they're about to cark it, as you say. I think I would, because I have some theological knowledge, having worked for a theological college back in the day, I would throw myself on the infinite mercy of God, because you can't have an infinite mercy if it then has a cutoff point saying, oh, I know it's infinite, but what you've done is beyond that. I think you can make a fairly good case for questioning. So you haven't got infinite mercy. You know? If they put me directly through to God, I could have that semantics question with him. It's probably my best shot. He might just get annoyed and send me to hell anyway, just for being so impertinent. But probably worth a try.
I like that one.
Yeah.
They'll probably go, oh, it's the infant. He's,
damn it. Yeah.
He's seen the Twitter campaign. Oh,
yeah.
Honestly, they're all doing it now.
Well, how about you? What would you say?
What would I say?
I always say the question at him as well.
Do you? Okay.
That is a fabulous question. And actually, you know, I'm pretty convinced I'm heading there. So. you know, I just think I'd probably, you know, if there's a stratification in hell, I think I'd probably write, I'm going to write it off. I'm just going to say, can I go travel first class? you know, but it depends on who's in that first class. I mean, you know, I don't really want to hang out with mass murdering dictators, although I do find them absolutely fascinating.
Well, really PR guys are probably in there as well. You know,
yeah, there'll be a few of them. There'll be a few. I think Gary Newman, I mean, you know, creatively great, but that interview, I think that actually, this is a terrible thing to say. I think the worst celebrity encounter, the one that spun out of control in a way I never expected, and it was with Lionel Blair. Wow. And who had turned up at my office, and I was busy trying to put together a TV piece for the 6:30 regional news. And it was like 20 past six and I still hadn't put my voice track on it. And I was under enormous stress.
Yeah, I bet.
And he turned up. He was expecting to do an interview up the line to London on the radio. And, you know, you can imagine Lionel Blair doesn't read the signals in the room, i.e. we're massively busy. Please shut the up.
Yeah.
He just jabbered. And I was not paying any attention to what he was saying. So everything I said was, yeah, no, as you do sometimes when you're in a conversation you can't get away from, but you don't really want to engage. And yeah, every time I said yes or no, I was saying the wrong thing because he was going, you think that? Oh, my God. You shouldn't be working for the BBC and all this sort of thing. And okay, I've no idea. So everything I did just wound him up even further.
Oh, brilliant.
You do that with me sometimes.
I do, yeah. You're right. So that you know, I think if Lionel Blair was in First Class of Hell, then I'm ducking it.
Okay.
Send me in with the plebs.
I'd probably just cry and hope they felt sorry for me and say, oh, go on then, go to heaven. None of your tears.
Sympathy vote.
That's a great question.
I came to business class once, so, you know, it does work.
It's a good question, though. Thank you for that.
That's all right.
Well, yeah. what a way to bring things to it's been a real pleasure speaking to you, Matt, and really, really enjoyed it. Where can people find more about you?
The best place is either to follow me on any social media, and I'm Cleric20. That's cleric as in the clerical words, and number 20. I have been for many years, and people didn't know why the hell I'd done that until they read Complete Darkness and realised that he's the main character of you know, Complete Darkness. And in the future, they put numbers in people's names because they can. And they
right. Yeah, I must have had your email, and I did wonder that.
It's also my email, has been for many years. Yeah, that sort of thing. So Google search that, find CompleteDarknessNovel.com, which is the website. You know, just...
Brilliant.
I look forward to engaging people. I love talking to people on social media, you know, good, bad or ugly.
Well, that's us in that.
Or indeed, Lionel Blair, if you were still with us. So, anyway, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure, Matt Hacock. Thank you.
Great.
And what a way to start the second half of the show with Aki making her presence felt. Hello, Aki. Well, lovely to speak to Matt. And let's, before we move on to talking about what we're doing in the next few days, let's look ahead to next week's guest.
So next week's guest is a lady called Rachel Corsini, who is in America. I'm not exactly sure where, but she's got a book coming out, I guess, in just over a week's time, called Sushi and Sea Lions. It's a gorgeous cover, so I'm looking forward to finding out more about her book.
Yeah, Rachel Corsini next week, then, our guest on the Hopcast Book Show. So the week to come. Well, we've got the coronation, we've had that.
And you're going to London tomorrow.
I am going to London. So the day after the coronation, which is a bit weird, I'm going to London to see some my oldest friends, one of whom has flown over with his American wife and his daughter. They split their time between Miami and Brooklyn. He works in New York. And they've flown over for the coronation because Marianne is a massive, massive royal fan. So lovely to see them. And, of course, it means the gathering of the clan. People, yeah. I was at sixth form college.
I was going to say, it's your sixth form mates, isn't it?
Yeah, my closest and oldest friends. And those types of relationships where you just slot straight back into the banter and the energy and the relationships that you've always had.
Yeah.
Even though we're now in our 50s.
So I was going to come with you, but I decided against it in the end.
Yeah, you did.
Partly because I just thought it's you and all your sixth form friends. It's quite nice, you know, to have that dynamic. And also, I've just got too much to do.
You have. You have frankly. So much to do. Well, you both have quite a bit. And we are also building up to a little trip to Bristol for next. Well, we'll be reporting from Crime Fest next week. We're not actually going for the whole thing. We're going for just the day. We'll record something there briefly, you know, probably do the body of the show.
Yeah.
While we're in Bristol. Chance to catch up with some of our authors and obviously some of the big names that are there. Just rub shoulders, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Check in, really. We went for the whole lot last year, but we couldn't justify the expense this year of a hotel for three nights. And the price of the tickets was monumental. So we will just be hanging out in the bar for a bit.
Yes, drinking gin and tonic.
Well, yeah. I mean,
that's, if maybe.
Well, maybe. If I'm driving, that won't be happening. So I'll make up for it tomorrow.
Oh, I'll drink some gin for you then, shall I?
Yeah, yeah. We are, you know, tons and tons of projects. We are talking to, well, we might have some new author news for you by the end of next week, maybe, possibly.
Oh, potentially. It might be a little longer. I don't know. But we'll see.
We're working on it.
Are in negotiation with a very exciting
And I'm still working through submissions. And actually, yesterday I auditioned for a new audiobook project, which I'm very excited about, if I do get it, for a new company that I haven't worked with before in the United States. So that would be great. I had another offer of an audition today, but it was I needed to have an Irish New York accent.
Can you do an Irish New York accent?
It was a sort of mid-30s voice, which I can do, but I can't do that voice, that actual accent.
That's quite specific, isn't it?
It's very specific, and it was a romance, a steamy erotic romance.
And you're so good at that.
Well, I have a certain je ne sais quoi for that sort of thing. But it's not really my area
You're
of expertise.
You're better at battles.
I am better at battles.
In life as well.
Hardly. Anyway, thank you so much for joining us. Don't forget, of course, to check out our website, www.hobeck.net.
There is one thing I should say before you go into the final bit. Last week, we also took ownership of the Henshaw Press short story competition. So that started on Monday. And I confess I not forgot that we were taken over on that day, but it just slipped my mind because I was so busy. And then suddenly I realised and thought, oh, yes. So that's very exciting. We've had some entries already.
Yeah.
So if there are any budding short story writers out there, just check out www.henshawpress.co.uk to find out how to enter.
Yeah.
And top prize, £200.
Ooh, and it's four times a year that we're running this.
Yeah, it's four times a year, and the winning stories also get published in an anthology. So we're currently working on anthology of the winners of the last competition, plus a few before that, and that'll be published this June as well. So that's very exciting. That's why we're so busy doing that as well.
We're sort of piling ourselves on. That's a pile of Aki hair has just flown in the air. She jumps off the sofa. Bye, Aki. Well, it's our opportunity to say goodbye to you too. Thank you so much for joining us on the Hobcast Book Show. Don't forget to subscribe to it wherever you get your podcasts from. The more the merrier is the phrase. My name's Adrian Hobart.
My name is Rebecca Collins.
And we'll look forward to speaking to you next week. So between now and then, have a wonderful and
creative
week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Hobcast from Hobeck Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hobeck online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.